Tonight, I want us to look at Noah and just talk about Noah and who he was as a man and what we can learn from him. And before we start, I'm going to give us a little bit of a quick background, and it's from the verses that we just read, of kind of where Noah was and the place where he was living, the people that he was living with. If y'all look down, we're starting at verse 5 in chapter 6, Genesis 6, chapter verse 5. And basically here, if you look at verse 5 and then look at verses 11 and 12, it summarizes the state of the world that Noah was living in. And what it says is that man's wickedness was great, and that every inclination of his heart was evil all the time. And in the ESV it says continually, that every man on the earth had evil intent in his heart continually. It also says that the world was full of violence and that all people were corrupt. And then if you look in verse 6, it tells us that when God saw this, he was deeply grieved in his heart, that his heart was filled with pain. Now, the idea that we're supposed to get here when we read that verse is not that God realized he had messed up or made a mistake. He didn't look down and go, oh, shoot, I didn't know that would happen. He wasn't surprised. God knew it was coming. But even though he knew, it says he was deeply grieved in his heart. When God created man, creatures, the earth, after creation, what did God say when it was all done? What were the words he said? It's good. And after woman was created, he said it's very good. So creation in the world, when God looked at it, was very good. Now, can you imagine being God in 1,500 years after you have created this perfect world, looking down and seeing corruption, violence, evil, and hatred? That is why God's heart was grieved. That is why he was feeling so much pain. It was the exact opposite of what he felt when he first created the world. So in verse 17, and then again in verse 13, it repeats it. God concludes that he must wipe out the wickedness and reestablish creation, almost recreate the world over again. That he must fully execute judgment. In verse 13, he plainly states that he is going to put an end to all of it by destroying all of creation. So what God is doing is he's implementing the consequences of man's actions. He's implementing the consequences of the wickedness that man is carrying out, that is grieving him. But he had to do it because God has to be just. He is not able to ignore sin. He had to implement justice. And so that's where we find Noah. If he's just heard from God, God has just come to him to tell him what he's about to do. And if we start out, we look in verses 8 and 9. And what does it tell us in verses 8 and 9? What does it tell us about Noah? Okay, that he was righteous. What else does it say about Noah in verses 8 and 9? Okay, he found favor with God. He was righteous. He walked with God. And then what else? There's one more. He was blameless. Okay, so basically the structure of that is that Noah found favor in the eyes of God. Why? Because of three things. He was righteous, he was blameless, and he walked with God. And I want us to focus on those mostly tonight. Noah found favor in God's eyes because he was righteous. Now, what does the word righteous mean? If someone came up to you and said, you are so righteous, or you said, so-and-so, Sarah Ashley is so righteous. I mean, we don't really know what it means, right? We'd be like, oh, that's like a leftover word from the 80s. You know, skater punks say it. We don't really, it just means cool, you know? Or it might kind of make us think of like arrogance. If someone called me righteous, I would think like righteous, bad word following that, you know? That's what I would think. Okay, it's not a positive word is what I would think. But that's because our vernacular has changed the word righteous, and we no longer understand what it means. If you look up righteous in the dictionary, it means to be morally upright, to be virtuous. So it's not a bad thing. It's actually a good thing. So it means to make good decisions based on a high moral standard or code. Now, if we look at it through the lenses of the Bible in biblical terms, then righteousness is actually relational. Throughout the Bible, righteousness never stands alone. It's in the context of a relationship. A man is righteous when he conforms to the moral standards required in order to have a relationship with God. So think about that. In order for you and I to actually have a relationship with God, we have to be righteous. We have to be righteous. So what does that tell us about Noah? It tells us that Noah lived according to the law and the commands of God, that he was concerned with carrying out the requirements of God in order to have a relationship with him. So that totally changes it in my eyes. It's no longer some man just trying to do the right thing. It's someone, because of their love for God and their reverence for God, following his commands and his laws because he wants to be in a relationship with God. Now the next thing that we read is that Noah was blameless. And you might go, okay, isn't that the same thing? You know, maybe it's that like Bible repeating, like in Psalms, how they keep repeating things. But it's actually different. Righteousness has to do with our relationship with God and just between us and God. But blameless in the Bible has to do with our relationship with the world that we live in and with other people because of our relationship with God. But it has more to do with this relationship on earth. In Deuteronomy 18, man is told by God how to live as a follower of God among people who do not share our same faith or our same beliefs. Okay, so God is talking to Israel and he's saying, I know that you are living in a world of unbelief and amongst people who don't know me and don't live for me, who don't worship me. So he says, this is how you are to live. And he's spelling it out to them. And he explains that as followers of God, we must choose to not enter into the ungodly practices of the world. We have to look at the world around us and be able to identify that they are living in a way that God does not call us to live. And here's in verses 12 and 13 of Deuteronomy 18, here's what it says. For whoever does these things is detestable to the Lord. And because of these detestable things, the Lord your God will drive them out before you. And then in verse 13, you shall be blameless before the Lord your God. So you know what he's saying? He's saying anyone who gets involved in these ungodly practices of the world are not going to be able to be in relationship with me. But you, as you live blamelessly before the world, as I have called you to live, you will be able to be in a relationship with me. So the last, when God calls Noah blameless, what he's saying is that even though the world around him is corrupt, that he, Noah, has stood his ground and he has not fallen into the evil practices of the world around him. So to be blameless is to be set apart from the world that we live in. It's to be set apart from people who do not believe in God. Now, it does not mean that we separate ourselves out of the world, because we know that we're called to live in the world, but not to be of it. And this is why when we are told that Noah was blameless, it is emphasized right after that. It says he was blameless among the people that he lived with. So that's why it emphasizes that. It was a time when all people had chosen wickedness, but Noah did not. He did not give in to that. So the last description of Noah after that is that he walked with God. So Noah was righteous, he was blameless, and then he walked with God. Now, why do y'all think that that was added in to that? Because I kind of go, he's righteous, he's blameless, he's walking with God, obviously. I mean, we call that the Christian walk, right? So why do y'all think that third description was added in? How is it different from being righteous and blameless?
Maybe that he wasn't doing it out of feeling obligated, because of the way he lived his life, he actually had a relationship with God and was
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great answer. The truth is that we can easily fall into morality and right and good living, but fail to connect in a relationship with God. Many, many times in my Christian walk, I've found myself in that place where I was walking the walk, talking the talk, but I had no relationship with God. I did because I'm saved, but I wasn't spending time with Him. I mean, the picture that Noah walked with God is a great picture. When we think of Adam and Eve in the garden and how they walked with God, or right before this, Enoch was, honored for being this godly man. And the one description of him is that he walked with God. And that is how we are to be also. Our relationship with God is the heart of our faith. And without it, our faith is dead. It's dead. If we don't have a relationship with God, we can say any answer to any Bible question. We can live moral and upright lives. But without that relationship, it's dead. It means that we're just living out a religion without grounding. So not only did Noah live like a Christian and talk like a Christian before Christ, he walked with God. And he sought out an intimate relationship with God. And he listened for God's voice in his life. And I think that's the proof for us that he walked with God, is that he heard God's voice. He heard it. Why? Because he was stopping to listen. He was stopping to spend time with God and to say, I want to hear you. I want to know you. So when God spoke, Noah heard his voice and he listened. Now in verses 14 through 21, we read about what God asked Noah to do. And as we know, he had to build the boat, the flood was coming, and all of that stuff. He was going to preserve his family and every species on earth and everything. And after God is done explaining that, we are told something very, very simple about Noah. But it is so crucial to our understanding of what we are supposed to learn from the story of Noah. If y'all look in verse 6:22, and then also in chapter 7, verse 5, what does it say Noah did? Yeah, he did everything that God commanded. So simple. It's the most simple verse in this entire story. So Noah did it. Everything. All of it, exactly as God commanded him to do it. In the Storybook Bible, I think that Sally does a really good job of talking about the cost of obedience, especially in Noah's life. It paints a picture of what his obedience to God, that simple line, that simple obedience, what it must have cost him. And here's what she said. If you want to look, you can. It's on page 40. She says, Noah's neighbors came out to watch and point and laugh because they didn't believe Noah about the boat or the storm or needing to be rescued. And Noah must have looked rather silly. His boat was in the desert. The desert was nowhere near the sea, and there wasn't even a cloud in the sky. Why would anyone need an umbrella, let alone a boat? Now, the Bible doesn't actually tell us that anyone saw Noah building the boat. It doesn't tell us people pointed or made fun of him. We actually don't know that. But regardless of whether it happened, I guarantee obeying what God had asked him to do was not easy. Did y'all know that it took Noah 100 years to build the ark? 100 years. Now, granted, he lived like 900, but still, I mean, can you imagine if you just spent a month of your life building a boat in the desert for a flood? You've never even seen a flood before, but it's supposed to come and kill everyone. I mean, can you imagine even a week of your life doing this? And not only that, but when they got into the ark, did y'all know they sat in it for 1 week? For a whole week with all the stinky animals and 7 relatives. For 1 week, because Dad said, God's going to bring a flood. I mean, can you imagine like how tense it was by that 7th day? You know, if it doesn't rain today, Dad, I'm out of here. But just try to imagine what that was like for Noah to obey God when everything around him was screaming that he was crazy, screaming that it didn't make sense. Even the voices in his own head, I guarantee. And that is what obedience looks like. Rarely does it ever just go along with the culture around us, the way that God calls us to live, the things that he calls us to do. Rarely will a non-believer ever look on in your life when you are obeying God and say, huh, why didn't I think of that? I should have built an ark too. It will hardly ever happen. When I became a Christian, and I began to, I became a Christian at age 14 through Young Life. And over the next several years, you know, while you're starting to date boys and look into that area of your life, I started to learn and understand the purity and the standards that God gives us for our relationships with men. And I had to really think about it and make some hard decisions against the culture that I was living in. I didn't know any Christians. I didn't know anyone who would ever say no to a boy. I mean, all of my friends lost their virginity in the fifth grade. Yeah. So I'm sitting there going, okay, this is not easy. These are not easy decisions to make. But after I did make those decisions and those commitments to obey God and to follow how He calls us to be in relationships, I endured years of torture. I mean, probably, honestly, a decade of torture from my older sister. She is not a believer, and she loved making fun of my decisions with guys, and she loved pointing out my lack of love life or how boring things must have been, and she often told people that I was a lesbian. So I got to endure that for about 10 years of my life, literally up until I was engaged. but I share that not to make my sister look bad or to say anything bad about her, because she was being true to the world she lives in and who she is. But I share that to show a contrast that our lives should have when compared to the decisions in the lives of people who don't believe in Christ. We should look different. Our lives should look different, especially when we are obeying God. If you are living your life for God and obeying the way that He calls us to live, then you should feel then you should be faced with people who don't understand you. You should be faced with people who make fun of your decisions in life, who call you out on it, who make fun of you in front of other people. You should be facing those things as you seek to follow God. And even from people who you're close to, who love you and who love you, but just don't understand it. In the face of this, we are told that Noah obeyed. We are told that that he did exactly what God did. He didn't run off. He didn't try to get close to the sea. He didn't try to change it a little bit to make it make a little bit more sense. Nothing. He did exactly what God called him to do. And why did he do that? Because he was walking with God. Why did he obey? Because he was walking with God. Because he was in relationship with God. And because he was in relationship with God, he knew he could trust God. He knew that God had his good in mind. And he knew that living for God and making decisions for God always leads to true life. So after the flood, in verse 8:21, we learn about Noah's heart towards the Lord after it's all done. If you had spent 5 months, a little over 5 months, on a boat with 7 family members and every animal on the face of the earth, including their poop, what is the first thing you would do when the doors of the ark opened and you were allowed to go out on dry land? What are some things you might have done? Run, is that what you said? Run! Here, Ashley would run. What? Oh, yeah, take a bath. Things like that. I mean, all of these things. If I were on the ark, you know what I would do? I mean, I spend 1 weekend with my husband, who's the person I love the most in this world, and I need a break. Like, I need 1 day to myself or 1 night to myself or just something, you know, just me time. So for me, I would, like, leave and not come back for a while and clear my head, get some rest, get a pedicure, things like that. You know, I would go lay on the ground and look up at the sky. I would go feel the sun rays on my skin. That's what I would do. I would do things for me because I need it. I deserve it after 5 months on the ark. That's what I would do. But what did Noah do? That's not what Noah did. Noah worshipped God. The second he stepped off the boat, it tells us in verse 21 that he built an altar. He grabbed some of the animals that he had just saved and had been on a boat with him for 5 months, and he killed them. And he did it for God. His act of worship was a choice. and he had to make time for it. I guarantee it was probably not the first thing that Noah or his family that he had dragged onto the boat wanted to do. It was probably not the first thing. If anything, they were probably freaking out, going, okay, we need a house, we need shelter, we need crops, we need food, we need a plan, people. You know, that's what they were probably thinking when they got off the boat. But that's not what they did. And not only did Noah worship, but he sacrificed. Literally, he sacrificed. And if you think about it, all life on earth had been wiped out. Crops, animals, everything that they need for sustenance had been wiped out. The only things that had survived for them to eat were on the boat that he had built with his own hands and the animals that he had been taking care of for the last 5 months. So our natural inclination in times like that, if you put yourself back in Noah's mind to that spot, what is your natural inclination? It's going to be to protect those animals, to hoard them away, to carefully guard them, not to sacrifice them and give them to God. Because you know you don't eat a sacrifice. You leave it there. It stays. You don't get to eat it. So the last thing he would have thought of doing is let's take our food and let's just kill it and give it to God and not eat it. It's not our nature. That's not what we would have done. Because surely God would understand, right? God would say, it's all you have. I get it. You can worship me later. Do your thing. Have some crops. Let the animals have babies. And then you can worship me later. I mean, surely God would understand, right? But Noah knew that that was not the case. He knew that those animals did not belong to him. He knew that his life was not spared because of his own efforts. He knew that it was God's grace that had brought him to that point. He knew that his only provider was not himself, but was God. That God had kept him alive. And if God wanted to continue keeping Noah and his family alive, he would. And if he didn't want to keep them alive, they wouldn't live. And he knew that. He was standing in awe of who God is. That God is sovereign, that he's in control, that he is in charge of everything around us, including whether we have food to eat or not. And so in that simple act, Noah and his family are reminded that God loves them. They're reminded that God is truly our only provider. He is it. He is the one who puts money in our pockets and food on our tables. He is it. And that he will help them establish their lives once again. So Noah's act of worship, it was an act of trust and it was an act of submission in him doing that. Now, if y'all think about this, how does it apply to our lives? Right now, we are in a recession. And everyone knows it and we talk about it all the time. We are in a recession. And for some of y'all in this room, you might have had to move back to live with your parents in order to be able to save money and not go broke. Or maybe even live with your parents because they're struggling to pay their mortgage. Some of y'all are unemployed, looking for jobs, and you can't find one. You know, some of us are in jobs that we can't stand, but there's no other job to move to. Or maybe you're just on a tight budget, trying to make ends meet, and finding it hard to even have money to go see a movie with a friend. Whatever it is, we're all feeling what's going on right now, whether it's in our lives or the lives of someone that we love. But when we are in situations like that, our first inclination is to hoard, to carefully guard what we have. That's what hoarding means. It means to carefully guard what you have, even to the point that we no longer give to God what is his, because we think to ourselves, well, this is a special circumstance. Right now is a different time than normal. So God is going to understand. He doesn't want me to go hungry. He doesn't want me not to have plans this weekend. He doesn't want me to not have this and that. God would understand. And we put our giving on hold. And we start hoarding what we have. But the truth that Noah teaches us here, and that he teaches so well, is that anything that we have was given to us by God. That nothing that we have, we earned ourselves. Nothing. God is the one who gave us our gifts, our skills, our families, everything. He is our ultimate provider. And so in that, Noah knew that just as God had provided for him in the past, God would continue providing for him in the present and in the future. Whether you are living today in prosperity or poverty, part of our worship of God that helps us to trust and to submit to Him is giving of what we have back to Him. And I'm not just talking about tithing. I'm talking about all the different ways that we give things back to God. I mean, I remember back when I was on Young Life staff, how many times people gave me things, ski jackets, you know, just random things like that. They would just go, do you have this? Here, take it. It's North Face, brand new. Wear it once. You know, things like that. And so I had all these really awesome things in my house. And literally, within 1 year of owning something, I've used it for what I needed it for, and then God brought me someone who needed it. Right after that, it was the craziest thing. Every single time someone gave to me, God gave me a chance to continue giving it to the next person that He wanted me to give it to. So as we think about that, have you stopped tithing? Have you stopped giving back to God because you've forgotten that He owns everything that you have, that He is your provider, that you can trust Him? When you give things away, you will receive back. Do you trust God as Noah did with everything that you have? So as I close right now, I just want us to think about all that we can learn from the characters in the Old Testament and the stories in the Old Testament. I mean, just thinking about Noah and just going, okay, I always thought he was just this like kind of portly old bald guy or something on a boat, you know, with a bunch of animals, and that's it. You know, that's all I think of when I think of Noah. But now we've learned what it looks like to obey God. We've learned what it looks like to obey Him in a culture that is full of wickedness and ugliness. And we've learned about walking with God and how desperately we need to walk with God and to listen to Him and to worship Him with all that we are, with everything that we have, trusting and submitting to Him. And through Noah's story, you and I are reminded of God's great love for us, for even us. His love didn't just extend to Noah. But as you and I know, He saved Noah in order to save Israel, in order to save Jesus, who saved who? Me. He saved Noah to save me. I mean, think about that. It's amazing, and that's what the story of Noah reminds us of. And that's what every story in the Old Testament is telling us.